Hi, this is Steve Syverson. I am Dean of Admission Emeritus at Lawrence University. Welcome to the ALP, hosted by the best decision I ever made for Lawrence University.
Checks in the mail, Steve. Thank you. Well, that was nice. Thank you. I see we're going to be off to that kind of a start. Welcome to the ALP, the Admissions Leadership Podcast, a series of one-on-one conversations with people who have been climbing the leadership mountain in college admissions. Some are nearing the summit, some have already planted a flag there, are down on the other side of that mountain, but how did they get there? And what can other climbers learn from their mindsets, habits, and experiences? I'm your host, Ken Anselment, and for the last time saying Vice President for Enrollment at Lawrence University, and for the first of many times saying, and VP for Enrollment Management at RHB. Here it is. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Ken. This will be fun.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I don't hear any trepidation in your voice whatsoever. Ha ha! The tables have turned, Steve. I'm kidding.
And I'm clearly representative of your down the other side of the hill.
Well, that was because you had... Yeah, in our exchanges beforehand, you said I'm sure I'm on the other side, on the other side of the hill. So I
walking down the mountain.
There we go. With bucket loads of wisdom to share with everybody. But as I said,
if only I can remember them all.
Yes. I think you will remember more than you give yourself credit for. And if not, I'm teasing it out anyway. But I do want to say just here at the outset, it's May 2nd, 2022, when this episode drops. And it's my last day at Lawrence before I join my new colleagues on May 3rd at RHB. That's right. I gave myself a whole afternoon, I think, of downtime between gigs. But it seems fitting and proper to, you know, end this season of the ALP along with my career at Lawrence with the man who brought me to Lawrence University nearly 18 years ago, a giant in this profession upon whose shoulders so many of us have been lifted higher. And that is the man you heard already, Steve Syverson.
Maybe that's why my shoulders feel so worn down.
Yeah. Well, you've been carrying a lot of weight, man. That's... I still remember the phone call or the voicemail that changed my life when I came back from a Marquette retreat, loving my job. And then there's this guy, Steve Syverson, on my voicemail, goading me into applying for the gig at Lawrence. And I answered the bell.
That was a momentous moment for Lawrence University. And wow. As I said, best decision I ever made was getting you hooked into coming up and working with us. It's going to be tough for them to replace you.
I thank you for saying that. It's a wonderful place, as you know, and will attract wonderful people for the gig. You know, for some background, and I don't know, Steve, you might know this more than me, but I think what Lawrence has had for the past nearly four decades is fairly rare in higher ed these days. When did you join Lawrence? Steve,
was it 1983?
83. Okay.
I was there for 28 years.
I was going to say, Lawrence has had two chief enrollment officers for the past 39 years. You, who built the operation for the first 28, and then me, who tried not to break it over the last 11.
Well, and boy, things have changed in that time, too.
You think so?
I remember when I came on board, we had an enrollment that was a little under 1,000, I think. And okay. We'd been up as high as 1,400 back in the early 70s. And Rick Warsh, president, then said, okay, your job is to get us back up to 1,200 enrolled students. And I had an applicant pool the first year of 859 total applicants.
But who's counting?
Yeah, who's counting?
Steve,
it was
okay.
Incredible.
All right, so 859 applications. I'm just trying to get this, how much maybe the scope and scale has changed since then. So 859, you're looking for a first-year class of about 300. How many did you have to admit back then to get 300 students?
I honestly don't remember, but it was the bulk of the applicants. It was everyone we felt could do the work.
Okay, but you're still talking about a yield of over 30% at that point.
Oh yeah, our yields were substantially higher than they grew to be over the years.
Yeah.
Just reflecting back on how far it's changed. You know, I was at Pomona for 5 years before coming to Lawrence. At Pomona, we kept track of our applications on cards that went in a card file. And so we would make up a card when somebody's application came in, and on the card, we would go back and check off when they got their first teacher recommendation in and put a date in it and put a date in for the second teacher recommendation and all that sort of stuff. We tracked it on little 3x5 cards.
Okay. And then for your data visualization, you then pulled them all out and taped them up on a wall?
That would probably be right. I had the pleasure, I didn't have many mentors in terms of bosses in admissions, because I entered admissions and was there only 5 years before I became the dean at Lawrence. So right. I had two bosses. And the first one was Jack Quinlan, who was kind of the traditional dean of admissions back then, at least at small liberal arts colleges, as best I know, which is he had come out of the faculty. Okay. And a lot of admissions deans back then were faculty members who had moved over into admissions. And he was a chemistry professor, and he had moved into admissions and was so committed to the individual students and applicants. He developed just an elegant system for ensuring that every applicant was reviewed in a way that they had every possibility to shine. You know, there were multiple ways that they could surface in the applicant pool and things. And we did use a computer. We did track the numbers on the computer. It's just we didn't do any of the correspondence or the individual tracking on it. But we could look at these numbers and we could project yields and things like that. But he was so careful, and he was there till all hours reading applications and was incredibly committed. The next fellow that I worked for gave me a whole different view of what it meant or could mean to be an admissions dean. He came to us from another part of the country. He was very involved in kind of professional organizations like NACAC and regional ACACs. And honestly, during the first year that he was the dean at Pomona, he was out of the office on non-Pomona business, meaning on association business, going off and speaking at conferences and things, more than 50% of the days.
Oh, wow.
During his first year there. So it was radically different seeing these two. But it gave me some sense of being involved with the profession beyond the institution as well, which is something that stuck with me over the years, that I felt like, you know, it's important for us to have our institutional focus and perspective, and that obviously is our job. But at the same time, we need to be tending to the profession. We need to be figuring out ways that we can enhance the profession or advance the profession, look out for the needs of students more broadly than just at our institution. And I think sometimes some of us lose track of that.
Steve, was that second boss, the ACAC person, was he the seed planter for you? Because anybody who knows you knows that you are a NACAC champion. I even remember when I was working at Marquette, wondering who this bearded cat was who asked all the really hard questions at the WACAC state meetings. And I knew that you were someone who took this so very seriously because you cared. I mean, I came to learn that over the years too, but was that when the seed was planted for your affiliate activity?
Probably at some level. Obviously, I was just getting started in the profession.
Yeah.
And so he certainly exposed me to those things. I got involved just the last year before I came to Lawrence. So my fifth year in admissions, I got on the Admission Practices Committee, which was the ethics committee for Western ACAC.
Okay.
And that kind of opened my eyes to our ethical sort of commitments and the ways that we track that. And that certainly led to me then. When I got back here, I ended up being president of WACAC in Wisconsin soon after I arrived.
Let's get the new guy involved.
Yeah. and then ended up being very interested in being vice president back then of NACAC, the way the board was structured back then. And so I was the admission practices chair and one of the vice presidents of NACAC in that role in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And soon after your friend and my friend, Ray Brown, had been at Lawrence and then left Lawrence to go down to Marquette. Anyway, it's been interesting as I was reflecting, but I started thinking about it, and I have been involved. I have been fortunate to have been involved in a whole batch of sort of major or pivotal kinds of organizations. I was involved on the advisory board for FastWeb early on. I got involved on the advisory board for CapEx. Oh, way back when I was involved on the advisory board for College View, which was actually started by a Lawrence grad, Jim Brower, and was pre-internet, but it was the thing that they put units out in the high schools and there was a big disc and the colleges could buy into being on the disc. And then it would have kind of the equivalent of what we would now have out on a website, but to help students go through the college search process on that. And that got bought up by Hobson's. I was pretty involved with College Horizons and got Lawrence involved with College Horizons early on. Colleges that changed lives.
That's
test optional movement. You know, I mean, there have been lots of ways to get involved with the profession, and hopefully these various organizations have helped to move us ahead as a profession. And I hate to call us an industry. I like profession better than industry.
Yeah, that works. A couple things you just mentioned give me an entry point to something I did want to talk about, which was, you know, the integrity and ethics is a theme that comes up a lot when, at least when I think about you and when people talk about you. In fact, I reached out to a couple folks for their thoughts on Mr. Steve Syverson. And this is the This Is Your Life section of the show, Steve. You didn't know I was going to do this, but too bad. We both have known Jim Miller for a really long time. Former president of NACAC himself, long-serving chief enrollment guy up at UW-Superior and at Northland College. But Jim said, above all else, I admire Steve for his unwavering commitment to preserving and promoting the standards of ethical behavior that were, and he puts in parentheses, and hopefully are, central to our profession. His engagement with NACAC and other projects on which he labored have informed our work and have benefited students and families. He should be proud of his legacy. And Patrick O'Connor, partner in crime with you and a former, an alumnus of the ALP himself, said, I've long respected Steve for his integrity, his commitment to principle, his ability to see a bigger picture, his warmth and his humor. And that dashing grin is also a great icebreaker, which is a very Patrick thing to say.
Dashing grin. Hey,
you have
I'll
a dashing
it.
Grin. Yeah. Well, you know, it's, but the integrity and ethics piece to you has been, as long as I've known you and even before I actually knew you, but knew who you were, kind of a core piece of your professional identity and personal identity.
I appreciate that.
You know, it's true. It becomes even more noteworthy, I think, when they stand out in relief against a backdrop that may have a slightly different shade to it. But so it'll sound strange to ask this question. I think you may have started to get there, which is, where do you think this applied moral compass for you comes from?
I don't know what the answer is of where it came from. Probably my parents, probably growing up, you know, I think a commitment to fairness and equity and treating people right and things like that. I mean, colleges in many ways hold all the cards in this relationship with high schools and with students. And the more power you have, in essence, the more responsibility you have to use it appropriately or conscientiously. Mm-hmm. I know that a couple of things have struck me. This is not specifically in response to the ethics thing, but a couple of learning experiences. While I may not have had many bosses along the way to learn from, I've learned a lot from, in particular, our students over time.
Hmm.
And one thing that really struck me in my former career, I worked with developmentally disabled adults. I worked with people who couldn't live independently, but we ran a daytime program. And it was in East LA, and I was essentially the only Anglo on the program. It was a Mexican-American community. And so I got a little bit of a glimpse then of what it feels like to be the outsider, you know, only a clue. I'm privileged, middle class, white male, you know, I got all the privileges in the world. But this gave me some sense of what it felt like to at least be kind of an outsider. I remember poignantly a conversation I had with a student from Southside of Chicago who was in Old World Industries,
the Old World
internship
Industries.
Scholarship internship program. Yeah. And I was talking to this young man, and we had this great conversation. He was about a sophomore at Lawrence at that time. And he said, you know, it's tough. I don't really fit in up here. I don't feel like I fit in up here. I feel like I'm sort of an outsider at Lawrence. It's such a predominantly white institution and community. And I feel like I don't fit in. When I go home for the summer, I don't fit in there anymore either, because of having been up here and stepped outside of it. I'm not just hanging out down there. And it gave me some insight into what we, in a sense, do. We think we're doing this wonderful thing, and we often are, for some of these underrepresented populations by getting them to our elite liberal arts college campus and giving them that kind of a great education. But in some ways, they've taken this big step that makes them potentially not fit in anymore in where their kind of normal life is. And so now they're, you know, which world do they even live in if they feel like they don't fit into either one anymore? And I think being sensitive to things like that, all of these things, we need to make sure students are treated right.
Yeah.
And that's what the ethical guidelines were designed to do. When I was AP chair back in the late 88 to 91, my first service on the NACAC board, I remember one of the big issues then was the May 1st deadline. And back then, because we didn't have email and things like that, it was a lot tougher to do surveys and find out stuff. So we sent out this mailing to deans of admission all across the country, and in particular zeroed in on a number of them who weren't even getting their financial aid awards out to students until the summer. And it gave me this perspective. Well, it gave me this perspective. I suddenly realized we have these sort of overlapping universes of colleges, you know, small liberal arts college, elite small liberal arts college, large public flagship, public, but non-flagship, you know, little Bible colleges, all these kinds of things. And to the extent that a student applied only within one of those universes, the norms were pretty much the same. And they would get treated, there was sort of a set of rules that worked for them. Once they started applying across those universes, they bumped up against all kinds of things that we as institutions needed to do a better job of policing. The reason, and now having worked at University of Washington Bothell, you know, my swan song in terms of my career, it gave me a better understanding of that. They don't get their financial aid, sort of, they don't even have their tuition set until the middle of the summer. And so way back in the 80s, when we were challenging some colleges for requiring deposits from students before they knew about financial aid, these were public institutions, and they said, well, we can't give them financial aid. We don't know what our tuition is yet. We don't find that out until July 1st, you know, when the state passes its budget or something. And you thought, oh my gosh, how can that be? How would any student enroll unless they knew about their financial aid and the cost of the institution ahead of time? And yet, for that set of schools, it wasn't a problem, because if they were applying to all, that was just the norm.
Right.
It's a fascinating world that we live in, and we have to recognize that the students cross those barriers often.
Yeah.
And we're often not aware of them, because if all you've ever worked at is private liberal arts college, that's all you know.
That's
sorry, I got you off track.
No, not at all. No, I am chiding myself for doing like a when you started to tell the story about colleges that were getting their aid offers out. after May 1st. I'm like, well, who does that anymore? And that just realizes, I just revealed or divulged my own myopia from my own position. And, you know, that's one of the things too, that, you know, if I had to put on the Steve Syverson chart of characteristics is your, and Jen England also said this, because I asked Jen, I'm not leading up to this, but Jen England wrote a few things about you, but one of the things she said, and so I'll quote her, is Steve taught me that taking the extra time to look at something from multiple angles is always worth the investment. And that's something that I've always found remarkable about you is, and it, we would sometimes joke, you were playing chess and I was playing checkers. Like I was thinking about the next move and you were thinking about the 12th move and, you know, always thinking about the consequences of a decision and some of the things that might be around the corner that other people weren't always anticipating. Did you play chess, by the way?
Not well.
That was such a you thing.
And that characteristic that you're describing, I think I may have inherited. It drives my wife crazy because she says, the other side of the argument. You never just take one look at it. You always have to look at it another way. And it makes it hard to have the conversation. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you a story. You may not want to leave this on the thing, but
we'll find out, won't we?
At my dad's memorial service, there were a number of people who gave testimonials, and he was an engineer, and he was actually involved. We have this great picture of him when he was early on with an IBM 360 computer in the back. It takes up a whole room, you know, early on in the computing thing. And he was featured in a book at the company that he worked for, which was a huge engineering firm. And they had to put together a book to try to convince their engineers that there was some future for this thing called a computer that wasn't all accomplished with their slide rules and things, and that there was actually value to this. And Dad was a big proponent of this. But and my dad just read everything all the time. It was incredible. So one of the engineers who had worked with him said, oh, yeah, Howard knew something about anything, and he would talk your ear off about it. And one day I drew the short straw. And so they sent me in to your dad's office to ask him about milk. And sure enough, 20 minutes later, I came out knowing more about milk than I ever could have imagined anybody needed to know. So I think some of it comes from Dad.
Yeah. Well, that's staying in the episode, Steve. And you have unwittingly teed me up for two other people here. One is Karin, Karin Smith, who longtime collaborator at Lawrence and now down at Beloit College. But she would say, I'll put it this way. There's a common theme in what Karin has to say about you. Long, really long emails, long stories, long conversations, long on professionalism, long on patience, and long on his care and concern for others in our profession. And I want to piggyback one other on top of that. You're familiar with this fella, Ray Brown, right?
Yep.
So Ray says, one of the fun, funny things about Steve that we all know is his propensity to talk. And your story about your dad is so spot on. So Ray says, as you may remember, he and I traveled together several years and shared rooms many times over these years. And people listening to this who are maybe of a younger generation might say, wait a minute, you all used to share rooms? Yes. Yes, we did. So Ray says, at night, Steve would be talking away, of course, and I'd be in my bed trying to listen and even more trying to stay awake. And Steve used to say he knew when to stop yakking when he heard me starting to snore. But he goes on and he says, we all get a kick out of stories like that. But truth be told, Steve weighs in on things largely because he always has something insightful to say. In terms of native intelligence, he is clearly one of the smartest people to have graced this profession.
That's embarrassing.
Well, but it's true, Steve. I mean, I never heard you talk about milk, but you're a deep thinker, and that ability to see multiple sides of things for people who have had the opportunity to work with you is a really... I think in a world where we have to make so many decisions so quickly, that skill is something that may be in shorter supply, or at least in less demand if I could bottle that up and carry that with me, I think I would be, I'd be doing well in this world. But yeah, I mean, I'm not leading to anything other than that actually follows really well what your dad's friend said about your dad, because it describes you to a T. And that answers the question, which is where the heck did that come from? But the other thing is, I think you always, one of the things I knew about you before I knew you, because I read about you in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or wherever, because you became this person that media folks would go to get good, thoughtful responses to the questions that they were seeking answers to.
And sometimes they even quoted it correctly.
Yeah, I remember you told stories about how you got misquoted once and you were scared for your life and your job. Do you remember that?
Yes, I absolutely do. There was a fellow who was like a stringer reporter or something. He was actually a professor at one of the colleges out there. And he caught up with me at a NACAC conference. And I was lamenting how there's no auditing of the reporting of things like test scores, you know, and I said, this test score, we're out of whack here. You've got the rankings, you've got schools trying to look better because they think if they look, everybody wants to look like Harvard, because if they look like Harvard, they'll probably be more selective and get more students to come, right, and more right. attractive. And I said, so, you know, I mean, the reality is somebody could just make up those numbers. They could just put down, this is their average SAT and this is their average ACT and submit it. And nobody ever checks any of that. And he ended up quoting me that at Lawrence, that's what we did.
Oh, jeez.
And I called him
late
on a Sunday night. And I just said, I mean, I was virtually in tears because this was the antithesis of what I was doing. I said, how could you say that? And he said, well, I talked to a number of other people and I couldn't. Nobody would admit to doing it. And I needed that. And I said, so you just made it up and you just attributed it to me when I'm trying to champion just the opposite of this? You attribute it to us doing that at Lawrence? I was devastated, absolutely devastated. And I remember one of our trustees, because we were having a trustee meeting soon thereafter, I figured they were going to just nail me on this thing. And he said, that's why I never talk to the newspapers, because you're just as likely to get damaged. Because from my perspective, I thought it was good. It would help position Lawrence as being a highly ethical place. And it came out the other way. Mm-hmm. I thought my career was over. I really did.
But there was no blowback at all?
Not ultimately. The trustees, several of the trustees sort of laughed about it and talked to me and said, you know, you get misquoted. It happens all the time.
Oh, wow. That's forgiving.
Yeah, it was.
Good for you. Well, and good for us. That's something that you taught me, and I think more by doing it than by telling me how to do it, was how to leverage the power of this role, even from a little place like Lawrence University, but to use the power of the role and your own point of view to advance the cause of your institution and the profession. Was there a point where you recognized that that was a thing you could do?
I don't think there was a particular point that I recognized that. It seemed to make sense when you're trying to be. Lawrence is a very small voice in a very noisy world. And to whatever extent you could get causes and things that made a difference. Obviously the test optional did a lot of that for us, because I jumped on that. But Ken, you are the epitome of that.
Well, that's not where we're supposed to go with this.
To reflect on some of the things you asked in the questions, you know, that you sent ahead of time, I would probably have been better served being an institutional researcher. I mean, I really enjoyed working with students. I really enjoyed the personal interaction. And the more you move up the ladder and, as we all know, the less of that becomes part of what you do or available to you. But for me, I'm a numbers geek. And I love trying to, you know, figure out, can we refine the projection model on our yield? And and as you remember, we really blew it that one year where we ended up with, what, 452 instead of 352? And
yeah, that was fun. We had those two years in a row, we admitted. Not like I remember those numbers.
Exactly. 1, it was exactly the same number.
It was 1,776 students each year.
And 1 year we enrolled, I think it was 352, and the other
exactly.
year it was 452.
Yep.
How does that happen? It just,
yep.
you know,
yeah.
And then we got to teach freshman studies.
That was
because
oh,
of
man.
It.
Yeah. And that was the plan, right? We both conspired and said, Hey, let's overshoot enrollment by 100 so that we can actually be called into service to teach freshman studies,
yeah.
which yeah. actually turned out to be just
a wonderful experience.
Oh my gosh. But I stuck you with Plato's Republic. You're welcome.
Yeah, that's right. Hi, I'm going recruiting in California. You get Plato's Republic.
Sorry.
Thanks.
I'll take the movie. I'll teach the movie.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, that was good.
Oh,
that was a good time. But you come in and you have the key to being a good leader is hire good people around you. Several of your past interviewees on the ALP have made that same comment, and
yep.
it's absolutely on target.
It's true. Yeah.
Surround yourself with really good people. Surround yourself with some people, hopefully, who have strengths in areas that you have weaknesses yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Be willing to listen to them. I think one of the key things is, you know, I often had ideas, and I think this was the cat's meow. The reality is, if you have an idea that you just think is the best thing since sliced bread, and the people around you are kind of you should question it. You need to have confidence in your own opinion. You know that you've got veto power ultimately if you need to do it. But the reality is if the people around you whom you trust, hopefully, are not persuaded that this is a great idea, you need to go back and question it yourself and try to figure out, okay, so why is it not selling to them? But
well, you always made that safe for us, Steve.
You come, as I said, best decision I ever made for Lawrence was hiring you. You come in with your charisma and your entrepreneurial promotional skill. When you announced the ALP, I said, yeah, this is Ken. This is his brand. It is because not that you did it for that reason, but you do the ALP and that brings additional visibility in a very credible, respected way to Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's good to piggyback. Every time I spoke at a conference, it was about, you know, something else, test optional for a lot of it.
Yeah.
But as long as that message was a good, respectable sort of message, my name is right above Lawrence University, and there's a halo effect that spins over to Lawrence on that.
That's right.
And so I think it's a good strategy, and you do it so well, just well. So well.
Thanks. I learned from a master, Steve.
No.
I still remember being blown away going to NACAC conferences, and we do the, you know, the reverse college fair. Well, I mean, we were still on the college fair side of the table as the college peeps, but all the secondary school folks and the independent counselor community would come up, and there would just be this line of people waiting to see you, waiting to talk to you. And talk to Lawrence, but they associated, I think so many people over the years associated Lawrence with you and vice versa. And it was this co-brand of an intelligent, thoughtful, high integrity type of place. And to be able to inherit that from you, and I jokingly said, and try not to break it for the last 11 years, but you know, you set up whoever would follow you in that role. To be in a, to use your position, the cat's meow, to be in the catbird seat for, you know, really taking that opportunity to continue to lift the institution and let it be that voice for how to do this in a right way. I don't want to say the right way, but a right way. So you taught me that. And I'm grateful for that. And I think Lawrence is grateful that you set us up that way.
Well, and I think that Lawrence is a very, very, as you know, a very special place. And over the years, we've had good support from Lawrence to be able to be involved and not just have it become completely a numbers game.
Yeah.
Though at the end of the game, it is. And that's something that always happens when you bring on a brand new admission officer who just graduated from your institution. Mm-hmm. And I remember I used to sometimes when I was involved in doing a little bit of the intro and orientation was, okay, now in some ways you're going to become exposed to the underbelly of higher education because you have this sense of your institution, mm-hmm. and you're now going to be exposed to the fact that in addition to being the institution you have a sense of, it's a business. Yeah. And somehow you need to keep the lights on and you mm-hmm. need to balance off the sort of financial needs of the institution. And a lot of that lands on our plate here at admissions in terms of being sensitive to it, trying to figure out how to achieve these goals and things is heavily in the admission and financial aid side of things. And that's something that your director and your dean are going to be struggling with in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. But you will now become exposed to in ways that you probably had no clue about when you were a student here.
Yeah. So yesterday in the admissions office, last week, I guess I should say, but we had our staff meeting and, it was my last meeting with the admissions staff. And one of the folks, I think it was Jen, actually said something about how one of the things she valued is that I was always transparent with some of the things that we were talking about with the board and at high levels of the institution. And the reason I do that is because you did the same thing with all of us, which was, I think information is power and information is currency. And I think sometimes people withhold information to have that, whatever, wealth or power, but you were always so generous with letting us in on the kind of the numbers part, the dollars part, how that all fit together, but it made us all smarter, better admission professionals. And I think that's part of the reason so many of us have gone on to stay in this profession and lead in other places. So you're right. That's the hard part, I think, for a lot of new folks to come in on, especially when they're seeing it at their own institution. But you can't do it well, I think, if you don't have that whole picture.
You just caused me to reflect on something else too, which is that there's a sort of a public persona or public understanding of higher ed, particularly in the admissions arena, that is skewed so heavily by the 30 or 40 or whatever the number is, super elite schools out
there. The usual suspects.
Yeah. And that everybody presumes that's the way it is everywhere. And you kind of have to keep getting the message out that, there are, 1,600 whatever the number is now, four-year colleges out there, most of whom provide a really good education, and to get fixated on, much less stressed out about admissions keyed off of the super elite places is really unfortunate. I mean, we've created an awful lot of stress for an awful lot of students out there. But the experience of being an admission officer, a new admission officer at one of those hyper elite places is probably very different. If you're a recent grad, it's probably very different because in many ways they don't cope with some of these same issues. Mm-hmm. And most of the institutions in the country are scrambling to try to enroll enough students to maintain the enrollments where they want them to be.
Right.
And I don't think the public understands that. And I think
heavens no,
it's unfortunate.
Well, and the system feeds itself because those hyper selectives end up being the places that even more people want to get in because it's a limited good.
Yeah.
It's a good, to be fair. Yeah.
To the people who are at those places, mm-hmm. I would have a little bit of a perspective message here. And that is
go.
We have conversations. So, Lawrence is sort of in that group, but not in the super elite group. But we have these conversations about access and diversity and trying to provide access for underrepresented groups. And those institutions go off and they, make good commitments. My alma mater, Pomona, has made tremendous commitments on that front. But as a society, we need to understand whether what we're doing is expanding the pool of those students who move on right. into college, or just expanding our institutional pool.
Yep.
Because if all we're doing is shuffling the deck and having more of them come to my institution and less to your institution, but it's still the same number who are going on to any higher ed, we haven't accomplished societal mission. And yet too often from the elite, the most elite institutions, the perspective tends to be, look at how well we're doing. Look at all this, these students, how we've increased the access. And we haven't really, for everybody, we've just increased the access to that particular institution for that right. set of students. And I think it's very difficult over the years talking to people who have worked only at the hyper elite places. I think they have a hard time getting out of that mindset and understanding what it really looks like elsewhere and what the really broader picture is. And when I was up at Bothell, that was a great experience to have gone there. I mean, here was an institution that was a regional public institution where more than half of our enrollment were transfer students from the community colleges. Half of our, you know, we were majority minority, and we had a majority of students on Pell Grants. And that was a real eye-opener to me, because I feel like the community colleges are often overlooked at what tremendous work they're doing at actually broadening the access, broadening the diversity. And certainly at Bothell, that was the way a student got started on it. And then they were able to come to Bothell and get a UW, the other UW, University of Washington degree. And I think it's really easy not to appreciate that when we get so caught up with our elitism and the very top little tier of schools right. being the critical places to be able to attend.
Right, right, right.
Sorry for that little sermon.
No, you're good. That tees up a fitting quote. So I have all these quotes here from people that I've reached out to ahead of time. Gotcha, Steve. But this one seems fitting. This comes from someone we both know very well, Lynn Van Zeeland. The person who keeps us going. I always call her the chief dean wrangler. Lynn was Steve's assistant and has been my assistant and part-time mom as well. But Lynn says, when I think of Steve, I always think of him as being one of the good guys, which I want to underscore that one, that one of the good guys, just always going for the side of the bigger picture, taking care of students. This is my part of adding to what Lynn said. But the other thing she says, because I think this is a really great point, and anybody who knows you has seen you do this. A memory of Steve that always brings a smile to my face, especially when I see something carelessly tossed aside, is his walks across campus, picking up any litter he saw along the way. One of the many quiet ways he displayed his leadership and caring, and that legacy lives with many of us. That is so yep. spot on.
I even do that on city streets sometimes. So,
well, yeah, of course you do. There were times when I was walking with you, Steve, and you would come back, and this wasn't like just picking up a napkin. You would have you would be carrying close to your chest all this garbage that you picked up across campus, waiting for the next garbage can you could find to dump stuff off into, or separate recyclables and trash.
From the selfish perspective of wanting your campus to look great,
that's right.
That makes a difference. From a broader selfish perspective, don't we all want to live in a clean world? Who wants to live surrounded by litter?
But
and I think you remember that Rick Warsh, President Warsh, would do the same thing. And he and I, when we'd walk out of, you know, like a meeting or something, we'd be walking across campus, and there'd be a piece of litter, and one or the other of us would say, "You going to get that?"
Nice.
And we pick it up. But Rick, here's the president of the institution doing the same thing on campus.
Yeah. Just servant leader. It would be, I'm for some reason, I'm thinking we missed an opportunity for a going away present for you with your retirement, which is we could have gotten you a walking stick with one of those little pegs at the bottom so you could just poke the garbage without bending over to pick it up. I mean, it would have been very you.
Well, it's becoming more relevant as I get older, too, not having to bend over.
Listen here, old man Syverson. Before we pivot to the, I'm looking at the time, before we pivot to the final descent, I'm going to close out with the voices of a few other folks, I think, just to encapsulate you. Going back to Jen, England, she's talking about when she had the opportunity to come out here. She said, I told my boss at Plymouth State in New Hampshire that I was leaving to come out to Appleton. And he said, quote, if you have a chance to work with Steve Cyrison, you have to go.
Oh, geez.
I had no idea that my boss in New Hampshire even knew Steve. But of course, I learned very quickly that Steve was known nationwide, and it put Lawrence admissions on the map. Beth DiStasio has four things to say about Steve Cyrison. Beth DiStasio is a longtime professor at Lawrence University, professor of biology, a Lawrence graduate herself, and a Lawrence parent. So she comes with like three times the authenticity and credibility. Beth says, Steve had a strong moral code, set a high bar for ethical behavior, full stop. He always had the best interest of the students in mind. He described our institution as it actually was without overselling it, and he wanted his team to know what we were doing in our courses and curricula. Thing three, he had a ready smile for everyone. And thing four, he was a great listener and wanted to involve faculty and admissions in a way that was mutually beneficial. And then the last, actually, no, two more. You ready?
Okay.
Just, I'm watching you squirm. Well, I can't see you, but I can just see you squirming. Like you're really small in your seat right now.
Yeah, that's about right.
Here comes James Miller. I started my work with Steve coming, and James is now he's the chief enrollment officer at Seattle University, right?
Right.
So another person that you launched into their own leadership gig. But James worked with you at Bothell, I think, right?
Right.
Okay.
He was our director. It isn't like that was his launching point. He did an admission for a while.
No, okay. But here we go. I started my work with Steve coming off a low point in my admissions career. I'd lost my sense of purpose and most critically, my heart for the students we all helped to steward through the admissions process. Steve's patient, kind, and human approach to our work together was like rain falling on earth that had been scorched by relentless drought.
Oh, jeez.
I've learned the following lessons from Steve. To prioritize the relationship between the student and the university over being correct. The problem-solving power of conversation and deliberation, how to listen well and speak gently, and that checking numbers every hour on the hour may indeed be detrimental to your mental health. my gratitude for our time together is immense to the point of being unmeasurable. And then here's the star on top of the Christmas tree. And this comes from someone I just saw earlier today, Nicole Schultz, who just loves you, Steve. Nicole was is the person who would always take care of cleaning up our house. She was the custodian who was assigned to the admissions office. And Nicole just said, Steve is the top angel. I think of him every day.
She was wonderful. She was special lady.
At the end of It's a Wonderful Life, Steve, it's one of my favorite movies. The entire, you've seen it.
I'm sure. Of ours too, yes.
Yeah.
Diana plays it every year.
The entire town comes together to help George Bailey in his time of need, repaying him for all the kindness and generosity he shared them over the years. And the folks I've read from today are, that's a handful, Steve, of the thousands of students and faculty and people in this profession you've lifted throughout your career. It's not over. But it's been a wonderful life. when you think about the arc of your own career, how does that land with you?
It's kind of interesting because there's a lot of stuff I would have done differently.
Of course you were going to say that, but that's not what we're going to talk about.
It has been a great profession. I don't know if I ever told you how I got started in it, but I got a call. I was working over in East LA and I got a call from Jim McMiniman, who was the associate dean of admission at Pomona, whom I had met once at a party at my track coach's house 2 years prior. And he called me and he said, hey, Steve, I'm leaving to go be the dean at Columbia University. And so there's an opening in the admission office. And when we were talking at the party a couple of years ago, it seemed like you'd be a really good admission officer. You ought to apply for this job.
Best interview ever.
The rest is history.
Best interview ever.
Yeah. because I had worked in the admission office as a work study student all through my time at Pomona. I sent out the catalogs. I went down to the post office. I put them, boxed them all up. Never once even remotely considered working in the admission office at the college. And that, and Jim launched me on it that way, which is just crazy because it's been a great profession. I particularly appreciate the fact that even though, you know, I love being at Lawrence and being there for such a long period of time, I appreciated this little gig after I retired the first time and failed, as my wife
flunked retirement. Yeah.
Flunked retirement. The Bothell thing was pretty interesting. And I kind of wish that early on I'd had a different kind of experience too, because I think it really helped to broaden my perspectives even beyond what they were previously.
But I'm glad you had the one you did, because I wouldn't be sitting here behind this mic talking to you about this. I wouldn't have been at Lawrence in the first place if you hadn't asked Ray Brown who you should be talking to about your next admission director. We have reached the top of the mountain, Mr. Syverson. Are you ready for the rapid descent?
Sure. So I think I'm ahead of you. I'm already down that side.
Anybody who has ever had a conversation with Steve knows that when he's not really excited about doing something but feels like he has to, he'll say, sure. So let's do the rapid descent, Steve. What's your walkout song?
That's the one I really don't have an answer for. I've thought about this and I really don't.
I got one for you then.
So I would love it if you have a suggestion.
Well, I've got one for you because I've often thought that Barry Gibb could be played by you in a movie about the Bee Gees, especially since it, you know, they're kind of a 70s type thing. So I'm thinking Stayin' Alive would be a very Syversonian walkout.
That would be appropriate.
Okay, there we go. That's the first time I've been able to assign a walkout song to somebody, but we'll go with that.
Just shows how much respect I have for you. Hire the good people, you know, and they'll take care of it.
Make decisions for you. There we go.
That's right. Let's see how you do on the next question.
Good. I'll fill in the blank for you on this one, too. What's the best thing you've read lately?
Probably 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World by Fareed Zakaria.
Okay. Good recommendation. Do you have something you're eager to read next?
Probably some kind of fluff.
Okay.
I don't read all that much, and I've been reading some stuff that Diana and her sister read, you know, sort of spy novels and things like that.
No shame in that. That's good. You're retired, man. You can, every day can be a beach read for you.
My wife finished reading the forgetting what it's called, but it was about the pandemic, the Spanish flu.
Oh, sure.
She'd be reading that at night and she'd say, oh, listen to this. And she'd read this thing and it sounds like a really interesting book. She liked reading these.
That sounds like fun. Crisis. Let's escape the pandemic by reading about another pandemic.
Well, it's incredible the stuff that they researched about this. And how many parallels there are.
As I'm sure you know, Steve, I'm making light. Something I did often.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Which is part of what I liked working about you. Kept everybody laughing.
What's your favorite thing to make in the kitchen?
I make practically nothing in the kitchen. I make some mean nachos, but that's because they're easy.
I also think the favorite thing you make in the kitchen is a crime scene when you're just grabbing other people's food. Because I think we've all seen with the long claw of the Syverson going into a bag of candy or, you know, a bag of chips or something. Anybody who's worked with you has had that experience, I think.
Yep, probably true.
Absolutely true. What do you use to take and keep your notes? And I know the answer to this question because I saw you do this for years, but...
Paper and pen.
Yep. Legal pad, yellow legal pad.
Yep, just a pad. Just writing down that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I keep all kinds of records on the computer, but when I'm thinking or trying to catch things that are happening around me, It's paper and pen.
My favorite was when we'd be in a staff meeting, which you'd, you know, let me run, and you'd sit next to me, and then you would open the legal pad. After I said something, you'd scribble something quickly, and then you'd close it again. I'm like, oh, God, what did I do? We'll talk about this later.
It was probably, oh, man, Ken had another really good idea.
No,
there.
It was actually a good coaching tip. You were seeing things that I was missing, and you helped me learn to read a room differently. So you would give me those sorts of tips. What's a memorable bit of advice you've received, Steve?
Probably the thing that I don't know that it was a piece of advice I received, and I think that at least one of your other people has mentioned it, but that thought of people won't remember what you say or do, they'll remember how you made them feel.
Maya Angelou.
Yeah. I used to have that on my desk at Lawrence, that saying, that statement.
Yeah.
But I just kind of never make it happen.
Oh, I don't know if that's true. I mean, I'm gonna disagree with you on that. When I interviewed Ray, so this is a story that I think seems now is a good time to bring this up. I've shared this with you before, but before I came up to Lawrence, Ray had coached me on what it was going to be like to work for you, and he had said something to the effect of, "Ken, you're in more of a need of an attaboy than a lot of folks. And Steve's not going to give you a lot of attaboys. So you're going to have to know that you've done a good job and be satisfied with that." And when I got to Lawrence and started working with you, turned out Ray was 100% wrong, because you gave me so many attaboys. You were so encouraging. And you made me feel like I could do this work, even when I wasn't quite sure if I could.
You may express it verbally, but you have never conveyed any lack of confidence in any setting I have ever seen you in.
If you've listened closely to the theme of these multiple seasons, there's a thread of the imposter that goes through all of these things, which is, okay, well, it's only a matter of time. Only a matter of time. But that's a long way of saying you gave me more confidence than I really had to do this work and to make mistakes. But I also have a string of texts that usually show up around this time of year from you, not in responses to things I've told you, but you just generating and just asking how things are going, because you know what this time of year means for me and for people in this work. So. Number 7, final. What's an item on your bucket list that you haven't yet checked off?
I thought about this a lot. There are lots of things I haven't checked off because I was too preoccupied with work for all those years. Yeah. But sort of something I'd really like to do is go down and go scuba diving off the Great Barrier Reef.
Ooh, okay.
Haven't gone scuba diving in years and years, and the equipment is all completely different. And it just, scuba diving is such a peaceful thing. And I would love to go down there and see the Great Barrier Reef. So that would be, I'll create the bucket list around that.
I hope you will make that happen, because that just sounds great. You have definitely earned that peace. Steve, we've reached the end of the show.
What about the podcast question?
Oh, that's right. I skipped the podcast one. That's like the only one you have an answer for.
That's the only one I had a real concrete answer for.
Steve, what's a favorite podcast that you'd like to listen to? And I know it's not this one.
The Market Report on NPR with Kai Ryssdal.
Okay, cool.
It's a numbers thing. It's great.
I'll put that back in. I'll put that in. All right. Well, Steve, as I said at the start of the show, it seems fitting to end this season and my last day at Lawrence with you, the person who was there on my first day at Lawrence. And so I'm grateful for both of those things, but especially for the bringing me to Lawrence piece.
I want to thank you for having picked up that voicemail and then having followed through all those years ago, because getting the opportunity, honor, and pleasure of working with you is one of the better experiences of my life. So I appreciate it. And I really commend you for all you're doing with ALP. It's I've listened to a good number of them, and you're doing a good job. I think people
may
really enjoy these.
Well, it's going to keep on going. We will be back in the fall for season 6 of the ALP with all new guests. This sounds like a promo, doesn't it? And some ALP alumni and all new stories. So yeah, it's going to continue. Absolutely. This is a labor of love, and I'm eager to continue doing it. But until the fall, and in the meantime, Steve, may all your big dreams come true, at least the good ones. And to you, dear listener, thanks for listening. Be well and do well.